It's still 1994.
Yeah, October. Right, it just started. Talking to Marcy Lockwood at KPFA, October 20th, 1994, in case this is transcribed 15 years from now. So I'll just ask you what I ask everybody else, which seems to be a good starting point. How did you happen to become involved with KPFA?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question.
Everybody says that.
It's a very, very good question. Let me finish signing these last two pieces here. For some reason, I've never learned to sign my name and talk at the same time. Mm-hmm. Okay, there we go. I got involved with KPFA back in 1980. I had moved up here from Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles working for a production company producing television and radio commercials. And the production company that I was working for, I started feeling very uncomfortable working for them when their next client became the Conservative Digest people. And I didn't feel that I could continue to work for such a company. I decided the Bay Area was probably better suited to me to live as a lifestyle. I moved up to Oakland without a job. And while I was looking for a job, I decided I needed to keep busy, so I started volunteering at KPFA in the women's department, producing pieces for the women's magazine and doing Midnight Becomes Eclectic, which was a women's music show.
Quickly, so you were on the air.
I was on the air. I remember my very first story was about Merle Wu getting fired from UC Berkeley. That story followed me for the next 10 years. I was the Merle Wu expert. So I was volunteering, and as one tends to do, who gets the cream rises to the top, I guess.
I've been told that in any cistern, the turds rise to the top.
Well, that may be too.
but they were talking about somebody else.
Could be true. The turds may have risen to the top in that way. I started working on the marathons and seeing terrible administrative problems with how we were running our marathons at that point, and then gradually got more and more involved in the subscriptions department. Eventually got hired as a subscriptions director. Which I stayed at for 3 years.
Was that by David?
By David Selnicker. First as half-time, then finally three-quarter, and then full-time. David then became executive director, and for about 5 months I worked with Pat Scott. But before Pat even came in, I had already started work on my own personal venture, which was a news and information program in... Hold on, could you pause it for a second? Greg?
Going again.
I had started working on my own project, which was this European venture that I was telling you about earlier. Eventually moved to Europe, and after 5 months working with Pat, not because I didn't want to work with Pat, I left to go to Europe and stayed away for about 3 years and missed the Bay Area. It was really as simple as missing the Bay Area. I came back to the Bay Area again looking for a job. Without a job, and KPFA had the job of assistant manager opened, which I got. And while Pat was busy with the building and the construction, the assistant manager really became more of the day-to-day business manager, station manager, while Pat was away. The building was done, and everyone had kind of figured that Pat was going to move on at that point, and she didn't. She stayed here as manager, and I, still her assistant manager, ended up doing a lot of keeping her out of trouble a lot.
And she's going to tell me tomorrow what kind of trouble. I got an appointment.
Well, she, I think Pat is an excellent manager. I really believe that she was a good thing for KPFA. She wanted to move much faster than the staff was ready to move. And I ended up troubleshooting a lot through that year or so.
As I told her this morning, the only person that I ever knew at KPFA that didn't make enemies was the night janitor.
The night janitor here now makes enemies because people sleep in the station and he calls me up and says, there's somebody sleeping in the control room. Come over here right away. Excuse me, I didn't mean to blast your ears there.
All right, they're tough.
And then as the situation in Washington deteriorated about 2 years ago with CPB and forward funding and Pacifica being named as one of the reasons, you know, the hate programming that we were allegedly putting on the air at KPFK. Pat was needed in the national office, and she, I think, really wanted out at that point anyway. So I became the acting manager when she moved into Pacifica.
And replaced David Seller.
Well, she, no, she, they created another job in Pacifica National, they called National Affairs Director. And Pat really was dealing with lobbying efforts more than anything else.
Oh, I see. Was David still
David was still the director, yes. And Pat became like the second person in the office. And her job really was just to deal with Congress and changing the image of Pacifica.
Yes, David told me that for the first time ever, Pacifica hired a professional lobbyist.
Lobbying firm, yes. We had a professional lobbying firm that Pat was working with, and she spent a lot of time in senators' offices and congressmen's offices and trying to explain that we weren't these terrible, horrible people, and if you just stop for a minute and look at what the good things we do, you'd see that we're really okay. And that was successful. Pat's work was very successful in Washington. But in the meantime, I was the acting manager for over a year before they finally made it official last February. So it was really a job that I had been ready to do for quite a while and kind of groomed to do, which I think Pacifica got smart in some ways and said, we need to bring in people from within because it's very hard to come into a station like a Pacifica station and just take over, be the manager.
People. That was a mistake made many, many times.
Many, many, many times.
The only training for a manager of KPFA is on-the-job training. Mm-hmm. There is no other.
That's right. That's true. And I think that because I came from within and really came up as a volunteer to subscriptions, and I really understood the business side and the development side as well as the programming side, it was a natural transition. And it was not nearly as devastating as it could have been to staff here.
And also, unlike a lot of them, you actually had professional experience in the production values of audiovisual things, which had to be done right.
I know an issue with many of the staff people with Pat was she didn't have that training. And when somebody would come to Pat and say, well, I'm going to be working on this project and it's going to take me 2 weeks to complete it, she didn't have an understanding of why is it taking so long? What could you possibly be doing that takes so long?
Yeah.
Well, it takes a long time to edit a show down, so.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Let me get straight. You were already in this building at the time that you officially took over?
No. We were in the old building.
You were still in the old building.
In fact, I would like to toot my own horn and say that I was responsible for the physical move. I was the person who dealt with the movers and the logistics around moving us here, and also dealt with the internal infrastructure of this building, the phone systems and the computer network. That was all coordinated by me to make sure that our move into this building was as smooth as it possibly could be.
Yeah.
And
well,
now
that was about, was it 91? Is that right?
October 91.
And you actually moved in officially as manager at what point?
February 94.
Ah, right. Yeah, that's what I meant. That you took over officially.
Officially,
after
we were in this building.
But as assistant, you were sort of de facto manager for a long time on practical details.
On the day-to-day details. I mean, Pat was she was the manager. There's no question that she was in charge. I was in the old building working day-to-day while she was over here supervising the construction people. Which, it was a two-person job. There's no way that you could be supervising the construction of a building like this and running a radio station at the same time, especially at KPFA.
Yeah. Were there people who had, how should we put this, an identity crisis in moving into such a shiny, clean new building?
The very first marathon that we did here was within 2 weeks of our move, and people kept saying, how are we going to pitch for money on the air? Our pitch for all these years has been, we're poor, we live in this horrible slum, and bare bones operation. How are we going to pitch this? We're in this beautiful building now, and it doesn't look like we need the money anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, our image is we're the same people. We're the same radio station. We're doing the same kind of things just because we happen to be housed in a nicer facility.
Mm-hmm. You're no longer sitting in rags out in front with a cap and a sign saying, "We'll talk for food."
Right. Right. Now we're sitting in the espresso bar.
It used to be Edie's.
Edie's is still there.
Yes, I heard an amusing anecdote, which, whether it's true or not, was nevertheless an amusing anecdote of the first night. I don't remember who said this to me, but someone is supposed to have said to Pat, "Well, it's all very nice, but it's kind of antiseptic, but it'll look okay after you get some posters up."
Right.
And she is supposed to have said, "We're not having any of that hippie shit around here." Right.
Yes, okay. She did say that.
I'm glad she did.
Yes, she did say that. And, you know, actually, it was kind of funny. Not funny. I think this is kind of another anecdote, if you will, that kind of typifies the volunteer mentality around this. About 6 months after we moved into this building, I was standing in the atrium upstairs, second floor, looking over into the lobby area, and one of the volunteers, who had been kind of an on-and-off volunteer for many years, who I knew, walked into the building for the first time. And he walked in and he saw this glorious atrium with the skylight opened, and he looked up at me and he goes, "I hate it. I hate this place. It's not KPFA. How could you work here? You've sold out," you know, that kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, Malcolm, I come here every day. I work here 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day. I love it. I'm here all the time. We have hot water. We have heat. We have air conditioning. We can actually get work done here." And it didn't sway him. I mean, the volunteers who come in on a very irregular basis were not happy with this building at all. Mm-hmm. But the staff, the people who mm-hmm. had to put up with the leaky mm-hmm. pipes and the plaster falling down around them and brushing off the plaster dust from their papers. And I remember in the old building coming in with gloves with the fingertips cut off because it was so cold in the winter. And one little electric heater in the middle of the room that was supposed to heat these rooms with 12, 14-foot mm-hmm. ceilings, and people huddling around this heater in the morning before they would start their day. And phone systems that you could never get a line out because there was only 3 lines out of the building. And mm-hmm. it really held you up if you were here every day. And the volunteers, I think, in many cases didn't understand how truly difficult it was to work in that kind of environment mm-hmm. and atmosphere. I think it made people much more productive being in this building.
Image, yeah. The image is the concern of those who don't have to live with image.
Right.
I remember all those years ago, I would call myself a member of one of the most purest, most idealistic factions of KPFA at that time. But if somebody had come up with this building and presented it to us, I would have gotten down on my knees and kissed the paving stones of it.
Well, the amazing thing about this building was that it was done completely outside of our... It did not jeopardize or cut into our operating budget at all. It was done with new money. And I think that what this building taught us, fundraising-wise, was that we have been too timid about asking for money. We had gotten on the air, and I was guilty of this as well, apologizing for asking people to make a $60 pledge. And in reality, and we were, you know, "I know it's going to be hard. None of you can afford $60. If you can only do $25, that's fine." And when we started doing the capital campaign for this building, what became very clear to the fundraising people was we just never asked. These people have money. There are many people in our audience, longtime listeners who are supporters of Pacifica. We just never asked them for more than $20. And now I go, whenever I go to the theater, the symphony, the ballet, whatever, and I look down the list of sponsors and benefactors of the opera or symphony and look to see if there's any names that I recognize from the KPFA subscriber list and say, "Oh, wow, this person gave $20,000 to the symphony. Why are they only giving us $100 a year? Maybe no one ever asked them." And that, the capital campaign, really opened people's eyes to that fact that many people, many longtime supporters of Pacifica, have the resources to make gifts to this organization, but no one ever asked them for them. And we started asking for them, and we got them. I mean, this building was a $3 million, or a little over $3 million. almost all of that was raised in pledges from longtime listeners and supporters.
Mm-hmm. Yes, now I understand that various people made it easy for you, like the city of Berkeley waived all kinds of red tape and extra charges and stuff that they could have slapped on if they had wanted to do so.
Yeah. The city of Berkeley was our friend.
Mm-hmm. And you had an architect who was a designer rather than an architect.
Denny Abrams.
Also responsible for that lovely block down on Fourth Street.
That's his little baby down there, Fourth Street, the whole Fourth Street shopping area.
Au Charmet. I've eaten down there three times in 1 week.
There you go. And if you go to Ginger Island, you'll notice mm-hmm. the same kind of architecture with that skylight opens in the middle mm-hmm. of their dining room there. Mm-hmm. Denny was a designer, but the actual architect was a guy named David Trachtenberg. He mm-hmm. was the actual licensed architect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say that although the building, and I don't mean to blast the building at all, I really don't. It's a wonderful building, and I'm very mm-hmm. grateful that we're here. When you have a designer designing a radio station, and now I know this, if I ever am in the position to design another radio station, you cannot sacrifice the infrastructure stuff, the soundproofing in the walls, for example. This building was designed to be multi-use, for multi-uses, or I don't know what the right word would be. We've got four studios downstairs. They were designed so that each one of them could operate simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality, so technically they were designed that way, but the reality of the building is that we can't do that because there's not soundproofing between the walls and between the upstairs and downstairs.
Yeah.
And so that gets
very, very expensive.
Absolutely, and we sacrifice that kind of stuff.
You get into floating on rubber and, mm-hmm. and all kinds of things that cost a hell of a lot.
But even simple, we're looking at some retrofitting stuff now. Foam injections into the walls and things like that. So there would be ways to rectify that problem, but we will deal with those piecemeal over the next several years, I'm sure. But the building looks beautiful.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. Has the new building had any kind of influence on the nature of your program?
It's allowed us to do much, much more in the way of live broadcasts. The performance studio downstairs, we probably do about 10 live performances a week now, mm-hmm. mostly music performances. So that has been a definite increase to what we had done before. Mm-hmm. We have room for a real record library in this building. So we have access to much more library, CD-type stuff. The technology in this building, all the digital technology that we have, has made things just a little bit easier. We're not dealing with stacks of, do you remember those old carts, the cartridges that we mm-hmm. you'd fumble around with and try to find the right one? Digicart now is the way to go. Yeah.
Actually, we didn't even have cartridges when I was there. One just had open reel.
Mm.
Small stuff was on 5-inch reels.
And you
threaded it.
Oh, well. Before my time, even.
Mm-hmm.
but I think that the capability of doing live broadcasts has been extremely helpful in our air sound. It's made our air much livelier. We will be, over the next several months, purchasing something called a KU portable uplink.
Now, David told me a lot about that, so I know... I've got that, essentially, right. And it sounds brilliant. He was outlining to me its potentialities, both for bringing the stations together in broadcast and also for linking up with the people who subscribe to the news service, for
right.
instance, and being able
to
give them first-class...
Well, the reality is, budget-wise, that what David probably was talking to you about is not going to happen right away.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, what we're doing is, what KPFA is doing, is purchasing this portable uplink, and this uplink will allow us to go out into various areas of the Bay Area, and in fact anywhere in North America, although I don't really see us sending somebody mm-hmm. to Saskatchewan or something right now, but mm-hmm. To allow us to go out into areas where there may be a demonstration going on or a concert or something and do a live broadcast from there. Mm-hmm. In the past, we've been limited to either getting a Marti shot, which we would have to get a direct line of sight to our transmitter, our tower. And even San Francisco, we couldn't get a line of sight because of the buildings in the way. Or we would have to order phone lines, which were extremely expensive, at least $1,000 each just for installation. And oftentimes we would have to make decisions not to broadcast something because we just couldn't afford it. So the KU will change.
Remember, we used to have one Class A phone line to Hertz Hall that sat in there. But if it went anywhere else, it was... and it was generally of a rather low quality. And Irwin Goldsmith and George Craig would spend half a day with the equalizers at opposite ends, trying to bring that link into some kind of linearity.
Well, we do it a lot more efficiently now. I think we have. I'm not sure what exactly we call them, data line, broadcast lines. I don't know what the technical. Delineation of them would be their data broadcast lines that we now have. We've got many of them right now. For example, Johnny Otis on Saturday mornings, because of his health, he can't travel down here every week. We've got phone lines directly to his studio and his cafe there. So every morning, every Saturday morning, he's coming in by phone line. We had, for a while, unfortunately, we pulled them just this last month, lines to Yerba Buena Center. And we were never able to make them really useful work for us. The Yerba Buena had some weird idea that if their show was not sold out, broadcasting it on KPFA would cut into their ticket sales. And they never understood that that was not the reality. So we ended up pulling those lines, but...
People are mad. They don't realize that any kind of publicity at all is good publicity.
I mean, the situation with Yerba Buena was that we would promo a show live on Saturday night. The saxophone quartet will be performing from Yerba Buena, and KPFA will be broadcasting live starting at 7:30. For tickets, call such and such a number. And on Friday afternoons, when they didn't sell out yet, they would say, "Oh, can't broadcast, sorry." Meanwhile, we had just given them a week and a half worth of free publicity and got nothing out of it. And it was a little upsetting. With Yerba Buena. So I did pull those lines just last month. I couldn't afford to keep them in anymore without getting anything for it. But, you know, the whole idea of the KU band to me is extremely exciting. I think that we're going to see some programs that we would never be able to be doing, have done in the past. Also, you know, just recently what the Persian Gulf War for us was... We were confronted with demonstrations going around town, all over town, and not being able to get coverage of them, and it forced us to go out and buy cellular phones. I mean, it was like, how simple. This cellular technology, is there. Let's use it. Let's get cellular phones. I mean, it's not great sound quality, but at least we can get a reporter out to these sites. So we've now purchased 3 cellular phones, and the news department uses them regularly.
To what extent do you use digital technology for recording?
We do have DAP machines downstairs. We do almost all of our carts now are produced direct, are mixed directly onto DigiCart. I am not the right person to really get into the technical stuff down in the studio. We do share a studio with Nata. Did you talk to anyone about that yet?
Remind me.
National Asian American Telecommunications Association.
We have a
relationship with NATA where they have a studio in our building downstairs, and we are able to use it when they're not using it. It is a digital studio, almost completely on digital. There's not a single tape machine in there. I hope to, very soon, and it's all dependent upon money, of course. Digital editing stations, digital workstation to edit. We've been watching these things for the last 3 or 4 years. They're finally starting to come down in price to our range. I mean,
digital design sound tools are real cheap. George Craig was telling me he's got those going at KTVU for sound work, and they're very popular over in London as well.
What are they sound?
Digidesign. And he says it's a local firm, not just Berkeley, Oakland, but it's East Bay. I'm quite sure. Hmm. And they're big news over in England. They've sold more digital editing facilities than anybody else.
Well, it's definitely something that's on our wish list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it all comes down to when can we afford to do it and what priorities do we have this month and when can we afford it? When can we afford it? We want it. When can we buy it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing about it, it's happening so fast that a lot of good equipment, I'm sure, is going to be coming on the market secondhand in practically no time at all.
That's what we're starting to see now. Is
yesterday's
the
newspapers.
The old, the $30,000 pieces of equipment that were being sold 3 years ago are now coming down to, being resold for $5,000 or $10,000.
Yeah. Well, you know what's happening in the computer.
Oh, yeah.
And comparable things are happening in the sound world as well. There's a miraculous little suitcase thing about this size from Sony. Now, mind you, it's megabucks still. Mm-hmm. It's I'm looking at $25,000, something like that. But it's a double debt operation designed specifically for radio journalists. Mm. You can record into it, and then you can edit on it. Mm-hmm. And editing on it involves spooling through at high speeds, selecting your out points and your in points, rehearsing them, making up your mind on the whole production, then pressing a button. And the whole thing zooms through from one DAT to another at double speed.
Hmm. Kind of like the way the old digital video editors work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You timestamp them and say, I want to cut from 24:36:19 to 24:36:22. Mm-hmm. Boom. It's done.
And the time-saving thing about this for news operations is that there's no load time and download time except just a single pass, and the single pass is at double speed.
Along this digital discussion line here, we're also looking at internet, the computer internet, and the Pacifica Archives will now be distributing or will now be putting snippets of some of their classical tapes, classical music, but classic speeches, on something called the radio internet. And Monitor Radio is already being distributed on radio internet. And this was going to allow for almost real-time up and downloading of audio files through the internet. It's at this point still a little out of the consumer's reach. I mean, most people don't have the technology in their their homes, but will within probably 5 years or less have the technology to. We'll be able to send audio files in real time through the internet, and it will be that fast.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm exploring on this book is the possibility of CD-ROM publication. Mm-hmm.
We're looking at that one right now too. The archives is looking at publishing their catalog on CD-ROM, and just have this is a such and such show, and this is the actual voice and the piece of the show.
Yeah. Well, Dick told me this, and he said that I ought to have a chat with the archivist
Burton
when I go down there.
Yeah.
Which she I will could, be next week.
She could use some. Push every now and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she's very skilled in the. She understands the whole computer realm right now, and as most of the managers in Pacifica, we have great visions and great dreams, and then you get bogged down in the day-to-day reality of running this radio station and dealing with the people and dealing with getting that program on the air when it needs to get on the air, and you tend to forget about the big picture.
Is anybody thinking about the fact that one may be staring sideways at something very different from a radio station? that radio stations of this sort may very well be coming somewhere close to their...
I think that's true. I believe that, actually. I've kind of been one of the people in Pacifica saying, we better start planning, we may be obsolete within 5 years. We may not need FM, we may not have FM radios within 5 years.
It's the sort of thing that Marshall McLuhan used to be saying all the time. Remember, in a case like this, he would be saying, "Remember, you're not in the radio business. You're in the information business." Mm-hmm. And there could be a time when FM radios will be there on the shelf with the buggy whips.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I totally believe that. The problem that I find is understanding that I understand this. I believe this to be true. But how do you prepare for something that you don't know what it's going to be? How do you prepare for it? How do we, we're aware of all the technology out there, but what's going to shake down? Are we going to make the beta mistake, or are we going to go with VHS? Is it going to turn? Which way? We've got to wait a little bit to see where mainstream is heading and be with them. I don't think that we're going to have the opportunity that Lou Hill and others had in 1949 of picking FM and happening to be the pioneer in the
all
FM
the
brand.
Time in the world to slowly get the money together and go out and peddle the sets along with the subscriptions to create the market.
Things move so quickly now. Even the difference between today and 4 years ago, before we had a fax machine in this building, and now 4 years later, we've got five or six fax machines in this building. We send files back and forth to LA via modem instantaneously. And I look back and I say, how did we ever function without these devices? Well, things moved a little slower. Mm-hmm. You waited 2 days to get the mail. And you just waited. And it was no big deal. And everything just moved at a slower pace. Things are moving so fast now. I spend probably an information overload. It's like an incredible amount of information that you have to figure out a way to digest every day. Between my voicemail, which has messages waiting for me when I walk in the morning, between my email, in-house email, and then my my America Online, my internet email, I spend the internet email, not and then the discussion groups that are going on that I monitor to see what they've said about Pacifica and KPFA. That's a good hour and a half every morning that I spend just absorbing the information that came in overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And just to keep up every day.
I see a potential dichotomy at some point between two sets of facts. One of them, that technology is taking the stations closer and closer together, and the possibilities of simultaneous broadcasting or near simultaneous broadcasting. And David talked to me a lot about the evolution of the Pacifica News Service that's been so important not only to Pacifica but to all of those little stations out there that are taking it as well. That on the one side, and on the other side, the fact that the identity of the Pacifica stations has always been to such an extent it's expression of local interests and of local problems.
Yeah, that's true. It really is a dichotomy. The staff and volunteers will say, what do we have over KQED? Well, we cover local issues. We're the local station. And it's true. We do cover local issues. We're not going to stop covering local issues. But we also have a lot of programs on that we are duplicating efforts on. Flashpoints, for example, our 5 to 6 p.m. show. They cover international news, and they do investigative reporting on, the flashpoints of the world: Haiti, Somalia, Bosnia. They are trying to get the CIA's role in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. That kind of story.
Yeah.
And WBAI New York has the same kind of program with the same kind of coverage. Well, that kind of show can be joined. That kind of information could be shared. The local stuff I don't think can ever go away from a Pacifica station, because that is what distinguishes us from NPR. There is never going to come a time, I believe there will never be a time, where we're taking 24 hours a day off the satellite. That won't happen. We won't be Pacifica then. Mm-hmm. There will be a time, I think, when we're taking more off the satellite. Right now, we're only taking 1 half-hour a day from Washington. I already see the next show from Washington coming on the air within the next 3 or 4 months, the Julianne Melveaux show. That's going to happen. That's going to be on KPFA's air, somewhere on our air. There will be a point that more of our programming will be joined, Pacifica joined. And all the Pacifica stations have the same vision of what we want to be. I mean, that's why we're a network. That's what Pacifica is.
Mm-hmm.
I
noticed in your report to the listener and this year's KPFA report that you mentioned that you had within the past year gone further in the direction of the banding of program time to specific kinds
strip programming.
Yeah.
Now we're even going to go farther than that. This is actually a very hot topic right now. I've just come back from the Pacifica National Board meeting and went into the program council yesterday and basically said, we are living on borrowed money now. We have 1 year to fix this. We've been given a 1 year grace period. We've got to fix our programming. People cannot listen to us. We have a very loyal core of listeners, and that's wonderful. But if you tune in KPFA at random at any given time, you're going to hear the most, you know, you're going to hear reggae one afternoon and you're going to hear bluegrass the next afternoon. And that's not the way people listen to the radio. You know, people want consistency. They want to know that they tune into the radio every day when they're on their way to work and they want the same type of program. They want information that they want to expect something. And we're not giving them what they expect. And it's a problem.
I must confess to a certain amount of nostalgia here for the idea that one purpose of KPFA at one time was regarded as being introducing people to things which they were not familiar with, and of putting things within a random context together with the program folio as a guide, for the purpose of expanding people's horizons.
No, I don't think that's changed. I think that what's changed is the way people use radio now. You know, up until, still, people consider 7 o'clock on KPFA prime time. The show was called Prime Time up until last year. Prime time is not 7 o'clock on the radio. Not anymore. It may have used to be. Maybe 20 years ago, it was 7 o'clock, prime time on the radio. Prime time is a television prime time. 7 o'clock is television prime time. And if you look at radio listening, just as, not just KPFA listening, but radio listening, all radio listening that goes on between 7 and 11 o'clock at night, it is the lowest point of the day. The fewest number of people are listening to radio at that point of the day.
Mm-hmm. What are the high points?
Morning drive. An evening drive.
Drive. Right, okay. Getting to work and getting from
getting
work.
To work and getting from work. And then there are the people who are fortunate enough to be able to listen to the radio during the day when they get to work. And they're listening to music. And they make a decision what music station they're going to listen to when they walk in their door, and they stick with that decision for the day. And we are not giving them the kind of consistency that they need. Now, within that, I mean, I'm not saying that we should abandon certain types of music not play thing, you know, not expand people's horizons, but the sound has got to be consistent with, it can't be a jarring change. We can't go from the news and information that is targeted at let me give you an example. We were Philip Mulderey, the morning show host, one of the morning show hosts. One morning we were having a staff meeting and he could not do the morning show. And as he was driving to the staff meeting, as I was driving to the staff meeting, his replacement was a volunteer, and she came in and did a show, and it was a good show. There was nothing wrong with the content, but it was so targeted, it was so focused. I mean, he came into this meeting and he said, "Well, we have the African-American women over 62 with 8 kids and 3 grandchildren. We've got that audience sewn up." Because that's how specific this program was being. Mm-hmm. It had no appeal.
Preferably in wheelchairs.
Yes, right. I mean, it had no broad appeal. It was dealing with an issue that could have only been of interest to those people. Mm-hmm. And I think what KPFA's programming needs to do is cover those kind of issues, but not be exclusive to that group, to that target audience. Mm-hmm. We need to expand, be more inclusive with our programming.
So how do you arrange time for the programs that do specifically aim at very small, specific interest groups?
I think that any program that aims at a specific interest group, the interest of that group needs to be expanded to another example, Living on Indian Time, it's Friday nights. I tune into that program and I feel like I've tuned into a soap opera 18 weeks into it. I don't know who the characters are. They're talking to a very small group of people who know all these inside. Well, I care about what's going on in that community. I'd like to know what's going on in the Native American community. Talk to me include me in your conversation. Don't, very simply, Ward Churchill, and don't assume that I know who he is. Tell me who he is. Tell me give me some more background. That way you're still dealing with the target audience, but you're including a broader audience into the discussion. And without...
It's what we always call preaching to the converted.
Yeah. And we still call it preaching to the converted. In fact, I was just on the air 2 weeks ago talking about preaching to the converted.
Mm-hmm.
We Pacifica, and I think this was very clear at this last board meeting, and it's been clear to KPFA for a while, we are not going to survive. I mean, we are really at a crossroads. We're really at a turning point right now. And unless we make some really tough programming choices to be inclusive of more people, to move from program to program and not kill our audience every hour and hope that we regain it. We've got to retain people. We've got to retain an audience and let them move with us from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Or we're not going to be here in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, financially, we just can't survive.
Yeah. One thing which has saddened me, and I'm not talking about KPFA, I'm talking about America, from the 1960s. During the 1960s, there was a magic chrysalis of time in which the oppressed minorities of America realized that they had more in common with each other than they had with those up there or out mm-hmm. there who were keeping them where they were. And you had Jews and blacks and WASPs and everybody down there in the South on the voter registration mm-hmm. programs. And whether it was a cloud cuckoo land or an impossible dream or whatever, nevertheless, at that moment in time, people who were minorities were together.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing that has happened in America more and more since is the people who don't realize who their real enemies are anymore. Mm-hmm. Their enemies aren't each other.
Mm-hmm.
Their enemies are those people with the power and the money
mm-hmm.
who are keeping them in mm-hmm. Where they are.
Well, the whole idea of building coalitions has kind of deteriorated. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't see, you see, we just did a series last spring. We reran it in September. It was called African Americans, American Jews, and Ambivalent Allies. And it dealt with what happened. The blacks and the Jews in the 60s were allies, strong allies. And now they're not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they're at war with each other. I mean, almost at war with each other. The teachings of a Louis Farrakhan, the preachings of a Louis Farrakhan are scapegoating Jews. Then the Jews are scapegoating black. All the cause of all your problems is this African American, this black man over here. The cause of all your problem is that money grabbing Jew over there. And we ran this 4-part series, which was, I think, the perfect. It exemplified to me what Pacifica's mission was, is mm-hmm. bringing people together, getting people to talk to each other, not about each other. And I don't know that
when you even get blacks and Latinos at each other's throats, then you're really splitting to a ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I think every minority feels that there is this much of a piece of a pie for minorities, and mm-hmm. if that guy gets it, I won't get it. And mm-hmm. I can't say I agree with that at all. I mean, I look at it from a different perspective, though, as a a white American, I probably don't understand the all of the racial tension around the racial issues. But as a Jewish American, I understand prejudice and I understand anti-Semitism, which I, and as I've been told now by many people of color, but you can pass. You don't have to say you're Jewish, but I do. It's an interesting, I think Pacifica's mission at this point is needed more than ever. And I love the fact that the Pacifica mission statement that was written in 1947 or 48 is just as, it seems to me like the Constitution. It is as applicable today as it was 45 years ago, if not more so. And I think that the founders of this organization had incredible, incredible vision and foresight to make this the mission of this organization. And it still should be, and it still needs to be more than ever, our mission to encourage peace and a last, to encourage, what is it, to promote peace and understanding between individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, and pluralistic community expression. I mean, the whole mission is still just.
I'm coming into this from outside after a long absence, but the general picture that I see building is one in which KPFA itself fragmented along minority special interest lines to a violent degree somewhere into the 70s.
Mid-70s, maybe?
And that in more recent times, what looks to me like a coming back together. Eric Barsfeld put it to me in an interesting way. He said in the 1970s the people in KPFA were all terribly aggressive and angry and always fighting with each other, and now he said they're all such nice people.
They're the same people in most cases.
Well, but things happened.
Well, I think that I think in the mid 70s, early 70s, everyone was trying to carve out their niche, to claim their airtime, to claim their department. And I always said, with the women's department, we will have succeeded with the women's department when we no longer need it. We will have succeeded with the third world department when we no longer need to have that department. In the case of the women's department at KPFA, we don't need that department anymore. Please never quote me on that.
Yeah, well, in Provincetown, they don't need a women's department in Provincetown. Mm-hmm. The gay contingent practically runs the town now.
It does, yeah.
But they're a different kind of a gay. They're it's almost like irrelevant. They're good business people. Mm-hmm. They're nice people. They want to keep the town clean. They want things to work.
Mm-hmm. Just like normal people, right?
Yeah, just like anybody else. I mean, you could be talking about the Irish in Boston. Mm-hmm. In Provincetown, going back a few years, you could have been talking about the Portuguese, whom the locals were, oh my God, the Portuguese are taking over the town, it's going to go to rock and ruin.
Well, I think for KPFA, what's so amazing to me, and we still get letters like this, of why don't you have more programming on about gay issues? Women are being given the short end of the stick at KPFA. Gay issues are being neglected at KPFA. And every time I have to write back to these people, I say, do you realize that KPFA management right now consists of two lesbians, managers, that more than 55% of our staff are women, that more than 20% of our staff is gay? These are outstanding numbers to me. I mean, this is unlike any other institution that I know of in this country.
And the ceiling hasn't fallen in.
And we're still operating. And how could you say that we ignore women's issues? I mean, what are you talking about? I really have to question these people's ideas of what they want from us. I mean, this to me, when I fill out those EEO reports, I am just astounded at how culturally diverse and racially diverse and sexually diverse this staff is. And there is no way that we do not bring our personal beliefs into this building. I mean, we don't check our color at the door. Yeah. We are doing, you know, we make decisions based on where we came from and who we are. Mm-hmm.
So much has happened. God, back in school and college, my gay friends, I wasn't gay myself, but my gay friends were nervous wrecks. Mm.
Afraid of being caught.
And always on the defensive. And,
well, now we're nervous wrecks because we're stressed out.
Yeah. Well, my gay friends these days are you know, they're by and large terribly happy people.
Mm-hmm. In San Francisco, we are. Mm-hmm. Most people are. I cannot imagine living in the heartland of America.
No, yeah. It's still. There are places where Jews have still got their problems, and I don't mean just in black areas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm. Yes. Still in Miami Beach, there are places. What was that thing with Feinstein and the? There was something about her house that there was something in their sales agreement that she could not sell her house to a black or a Jew. Mrs. Huffington brought this up.
I don't know about this.
It was something like from 1911 that was still attached to the deed of the house, and mm-hmm. it's like, how could you say that? I can't sell my house to a black or a Jew. It's too late. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's still on the books in many states and many places. But KPFA, I think what happened in the 70s around the segregation of the anger, we're starting to see that in society at large right now. There's an incredible amount of anger in racial minority groups. I think KPFA, I'm hoping that KPFA is just one step ahead of that and saying, we're not going to be fighting with each other. We've got to work together. This ain't going to work unless we're all working together. And check your baggage at the door. I happen to be black. You happen to be green. Let's move on. I think it's still important, though, to deal with issues out there. You know, when we start dealing with gang violence and the image of the black teenager. What our message is that they're not all bad. Mm-hmm. You know, what you see in the media is the worst of the worst. Remember, they're not all bad. And move beyond what your stereotype is and say, remember, these people are not all bad. Mm-hmm. There's some goodness that we're gonna have to find the good to get through this, whatever's going on out there. You're so lucky. I'm way late here.
Yeah.
Actually, the great thing is that my next meeting hasn't. I'm kind of peeking through the door. She hasn't shown up yet. But.
Right. So you're keeping an eye on.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, is there something I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
Probably, but I don't. I mean, I don't know what your how you're coming at this.
We
can talk
all
about
right.
our I'll great talk. Fundraising mm. efforts. We can talk mm-hmm. about how.
What I really am after is to try to tell the story of KPFA, and I've just about decided that I'm not going to go into the other stations. That's going to become an encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. I can, but staying with KPFA, I could. I want to write something which develops as a sort of a metaphor for what has happened to America and to Berkeley in those over those 40 going on 50 years.
Good luck.
Because it is because to a very real extent. KPFA is a kind of a metaphor for Berkeley, and Berkeley is a kind of a metaphor for America. Mm-hmm. Things have happened here with an intensity that is not so recognizable.
I think that the first thing that I would point on that one is, and maybe this is part of the metaphor of the world, for, you know, the microcosm of KPFA, is that I don't think of this as a Berkeley institution at all. The communication, the access that we now have to communication and the instantaneous nature of it is made this radio station. What I have tried to instill in the staff and the programmers in this station is, you are not Berkeley radio station. You are not Berkeley station. You are Northern California station. You must deal with issues in the South Bay, in the North Bay, and in Sacramento. You've got to get out of this Berkeley niche. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is completely due to how technology has allowed mm-hmm. us to get beyond this small area.
But I don't see that as a contradiction at all, because the people in Berkeley who think have themselves escaped from the Berkeley
But there's so many nerd. People in Berkeley who have not yet. I still get what I call the residual hippies coming mm-hmm. through here and cannot understand what's happened to KPFA. We have changed so much. What happened to my nice, friendly hippie radio station in the 1960s? And they're still here. They're still living here in Berkeley. They're still...
Oh, yeah, sure they're there. As good old Marshall McLuhan pointed out all those years ago, most people drive looking in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think more so in Berkeley than anywhere else, mm-hmm. because there's so many damn cops out there trying to get you.
Yeah, well, there's that. But it's... But Berkeley is one of those, well, it parallels my experience growing up in Provincetown, mm-hmm. An even smaller community, and terribly ingrown, and mm-hmm. all concentrating on their own interests and what was going on. I mean, even if you lived down along, you didn't even necessarily know what was happening up along. Mm. But what I discovered after I got out of that community and went off to university was that I was studying the people that lived three houses up the street. Mm. It was a place which was crowded with some of the most importantly, productively creative people mm-hmm. in America. And there was this distillation of creative energy in that place, and Berkeley has been much the same mm-hmm. in that respect. Whether you're counting Nobel Prize winners or writers or painters or artists or political activists mm-hmm. or whatever it is, you draw up a list of them, and a hell of a lot of them are going to have come to Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And then you can take this down to KPFA, mm-hmm. And the creative imaginations in the media, mm-hmm. in this country. In this little thing that I've written so far, I point to a time in the middle 1960s in New York City, where if you went looking for KPFA alumni, you would find Pauline Kael as the best critic mm-hmm. probably anywhere in America. You'd find John Leonard editing the Sunday New York Times Book mm-hmm. Review. You'd find Jack Nessel, the managing editor of New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. You'd find Alan Rich as that highly influential critic, first on the New York Times, mm-hmm. then on the Herald Trib, and then again on New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. And you'd find Eleanor McKinney heading up Broadcasting Foundation of America. Mm-hmm. We practically ran New York.
Mm-hmm. It's still a case. I think that the alumni of Pacifica stations are still out there. Unfortunately, they're getting trapped into NPR stations. I mean, we go from Pacifica to NPR. That's, you know, mm-hmm. Richard Gonzalez. I mean, Kathy McAnally. I mean, there's like a huge number of Pacifica-trained people moving into NPR, and eventually they move out beyond NPR. But mm-hmm. we're the training ground for so many, mm-hmm. for so much in the media field. You know, our training program, our apprenticeship training program, people graduate from that program and they're going out and getting jobs in commercial media. They're going to be influential people in these fields. And the seeds of Pacifica will mm-hmm. scatter even farther. Yeah.